Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. Early in 1961, President John F. Kennedy took an action that soon came to symbolize his presidency and America's changing relationship with much of the world beyond its borders. He established the Peace Corps. Now, three decades later, it's fitting and necessary for us to seek a better understanding of the history of a remarkable and enduring institution. My guest is Elizabeth Cobbs, Associate Professor of History at the University of San Diego. Elizabeth Cobbs, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
It's great to have you, Elizabeth, and what a marvelous work you're engaged in now, writing a history of the Peace Corps. Let me start our conversation with this question. When President Kennedy created the Peace Corps back in 1961, I think it met with something like 71% approval among the American population. It was enormous and immense. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that had to do with the feeling that this was a particularly American phenomena and a sort of a particularly American thing to do. I think, however, one of the contributions that your scholarship is making is to remind us that we have to put it in something of a broader context, that there were some other influences at work and perhaps some precedents for this great move. And would you tell us about them?
Yes. I think the Peace Corps was and is still seen as uniquely American. Sometimes that's with sort of a laugh that people give at its being a kind of typically naive American thing to do. Other times it's with a great sense of pride that Americans are known internationally as volunteers, that we are a group of people which is willing to lend a hand to each other and to other people around the world. And there's sort of a freshness and ingenuousness about Americans that is symbolized by the Peace Corps. And especially during the 1960s, when the Peace Corps had an evil twin, which was the Vietnam War, its purity and its lack of guile, I think, were seen as wonderful things about America that we could look upon with pride. And yet it's absolutely true that the Peace Corps was not alone. And in fact, what's remarkable to me, I started out to write a book about the Peace Corps and quickly found out that it would be really wrong, I mean, just wrong, to look at the Peace Corps in isolation. That in fact, it was a part of a move by a group of essentially Anglo, I'm kind of putting that in quotes, but Anglo countries that started various volunteer movements.
You mean Britain, Canada, Australia?
Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. In Australia and Britain, secular, meaning non-missionary, volunteer groups were started before the Peace Corps, going back to 1952 in Australia and 1957 in Great Britain. New Zealand also began a very small program in the mid-50s. Canada began its Peace Corps at the same time, within the same month that the United States did, and youth groups were starting these in all of these countries, even before the Peace Corps got going. So I try and look at this as something that emerged in almost a full-blown and very exciting and dynamic and dramatic way in a lot of places all at the same time. And, of course, that makes it interesting.
It sure does. Of course, another thing you do, Elizabeth, that I think is of equal importance is you remind us of our own history, too.
I think so. I think in looking at the Peace Corps, I'm looking really at it as an example or as a part of the history of the 60s, which has been much maligned since the 60s. And I'm looking at it as a manifestation of American reformism and also of a kind of global reformism that struck in this period of time, which I think helps perhaps us to feel a little more comfortable with it when we understand that the things we were inspired by were inspiring many other people in other parts of the globe, and the kinds of demands that were generated were felt in many places. And the love that the American people had for John F. Kennedy was shared, so there was something there.
Yeah. Remind us, perhaps in even more detail, Elizabeth, of some of these worldwide themes that were sort of providing context. I think that's a very valuable thing.
All right. Well, I see there are essentially four themes that are coming into the founding of the Peace Corps and groups like this in other Anglo countries and later in continental Europe. One of those is in America, it was a whole debate that occurred in the 1950s over national character. And this goes back a long ways to the end of the frontier and the sense that Americans had by the mid-20th century that they had lost their pioneer character. And I think when John Kennedy called for new frontiers, it was not an idle kind of comment, that he was speaking very directly to Americans who were concerned that they had just become organization men, that they were softies, that they had no real spine left, that all they could do was take orders, which of course was awful considering that Americans were trying to fight communism, in which supposedly all people knew how to do was to take orders. And here we were becoming, you know, copies of what we most abhorred in the world. So I think the debate over national character fed into all this and the loss of the frontier. I think another issue, which was, again, something that inspired people around the world, and not just in America, but was particularly true of Americans, was the rise of the philosophy and also the policy of what was called universalism. And universalism was essentially the idea that under the skin, that we are all the same, mm-hmm. and that we have the same rights.
So we have national character, universalism.
Race was the third component. And this was important, again, not just for Americans, although we know, of course, that race and segregation became very important issues for America beginning in the mid and late 50s. It was also an issue for members of the Commonwealth, and this is where we get into the larger picture of Anglo nations. After 1947, the Commonwealth was comprised of what they call the white dominions, and there were also now brown dominions after 1947, meaning
this is a result
India,
of decolonization.
Right, the decolonization of India, mm-hmm. which led to the creation of also of Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, and Pakistan. And what this meant was you had these sort of interesting scenarios. Or the Commonwealth was an egalitarian structure meant to put, began in 1930, meant to put Britain on the same par as its former dominions of Canada and New Zealand and South Africa and things like that. But once you had brown members, then suddenly the equality, the structure of equality took on a new dynamic because you had an equality built in that also now had to include race.
Would it be too much to say, Elizabeth, that one result of this, of the decolonization and this more varied racial mix in positions of leadership around the world, was essentially giving the Anglo nations, to use that phrase again, and the rest of the world too, something different to relate to. I mean, a world that was changed around them as they sort of watched it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In 1960, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it's 17 sub-Saharan African nations, black African nations, became independent. And this was a transformation of the world,
yeah.
and not everyone quite realized how it needed to be responded to. And I think this is one of Kennedy's geniuses, was that he had a sense that there really had to be a response of feeling, as well as form,
right.
to this event, to the advent of these new nations. And I think there was a part of the way in which the Peace Corps was created, partly to show the world that there were Americans who weren't racist,
yeah.
that you could send young people out and they could, a white hand could grasp a black hand and really do it. And a lot of the early pictures of the Peace Corps show these white faces against these very dark brown faces and touching and being with each other in ways that you would not see here in America.
Comfortably,
mm-hmm. right. And I think that that was a very important image and yeah. message.
Recapitulating for a moment, Elizabeth, we have national character, mm-hmm. universalism, and race. And
right.
The fourth
one is the rise of post-war philosophies. And again, this appeals to the global sense in which the Peace Corps was appealing to people around the world, and also the fact that their Peace Corps, or Peace Corps equivalents, started in all of the countries of Europe after 1961 and had already been going in the Anglo countries. But World War II prompted the rise and made more poignant and more important than ever philosophies which emphasized the potential for the individual to take a stand in the world. And I think that in a lot of ways, the experience of the war in which the individual counted for nothing, essentially, except perhaps as one of the 100 million who died, that the war, while it discounted individual personal worth, in some ways made individual personal worth all that much more, mm-hmm. more important as being perhaps the only thing that counted.
Is a lot of this thinking, Elizabeth, that you're referring to now, I think quite rightly, theologically inspired?
Two sources of inspiration, theological inspiration and also the inspiration of the European existentialists. So I'm looking at moralists like Martin Buber and Paul Tillich and Reinhold Niebuhr, who were theologians, and also looking at Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre. They relate to each other in the sense that the theologians emphasize, the individual human worth, the idea that that all the attempts to alienate others as being other than you were ultimately a part of an expression of our, in a sense, 20th century sickness,
yeah.
our the fact that we've all become means rather than ends. And the idea was to try and, instead of, here we've created a world, and all the things we've created, in a sense, are supposed to be for us, and yet they surround us and depersonalize us, yeah. And man, as they would have put it, or woman, or humans, are lost in the process. And then the existentialists, I think this relates to the work of the Peace Corps, because, first of all, many people in these other countries and in the United States were very fond of quoting existentialists like Camus and Sartre. But it also relates to the idea of the existential act, that is, that the only way you can create meaning in this meaningless 20th century world is through your own personal decision, your moment of epiphany, in a sense, where you realize that you alone can create meaning and can realize your potential. And I think for the Peace Corps, the act of going itself was, to some extent, what was truly significant, the idea that you were stepping out into the world, yeah. at this particular moment.
The figure of John F. Kennedy and the advent of the 1960s looms enormously in this. I mean, how do we translate these forces and these influences into the concrete act of the formation of the Peace Corps? What makes him do it, and what's the importance of him doing it in the at the very start, actually, of his administration?
Kennedy really did detonate this chemistry. It began during his campaign. He made a speech in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in late October 1960. So you see it's right on the eve of the election, where he asked a group of waiting students how many of them who were planning to be doctors would be willing to go to Ghana. Later at the Cow Palace in San Francisco on, I think it was the 2nd of November, again, just days or, you know, a few days before the election, he promised to start a Peace Corps should he be made president. What was remarkable, of course, was that people immediately responded. And before he was even inaugurated, thousands, 25,000 people wrote letters asking him to start the Peace Corps. More people wrote his transition team to ask to be, you know, put into the Peace Corps than people who asked to be put into any other part of the administration. Yeah. More people want to join the Peace Corps, which was non-existent, than all of the other existing agencies of the government put together.
He touched a chord.
He touched a chord.
Again, you put your finger right on it, and you give us a real sense, give me a real sense, certainly, of the atmosphere and the charisma, to use a much overworked word, that he brought to bear on this, and this emotion that was in the public, waiting to be discovered, in a sense, you might say, or detonated. Was there another calculation, though, as well? And here I ask, clearly this all happened at the height of the Cold War, and also being a master politician, I wonder if how that would have played into the Kennedy decision to begin this. I mean, were there another set of concerns? I'm not suggesting anything dishonorable at all, but that you would have to, in a real politics sort of way, have perhaps additional reasons for wanting to do this.
Oh, absolutely, especially in the sense that the Cold War permeated every aspect of American culture and politics in this period of time, and it probably wouldn't have been possible to refer to the creation of any program, even if it were poultry breeding, without in some way tying it into the Cold War. And this was certainly true of the Peace Corps, and there was a harder edge to it, in the sense of, again, referring to the African diplomats who were offered housing by the Soviet mission to the United Nations in New York. Well, the Soviets were upstaging us terribly in response to these race questions. Of course, they didn't have racial problems on their own front, and whatever ethnic problems they had, they managed to squelch without us knowing too much about it. But there was a way in which Americans had a lot to prove and a lot to live down when it came to race issues. Here America was proclaiming to be the leader of the world, and yet, you know, we couldn't, we were proclaiming the four freedoms and not extending them to our own people.
Yeah.
So I think that there was that element of it. At the same time, I think that there was a great emphasis within the Peace Corps on not simply being a tool of the Cold War. And I think there's a way, sometimes people can see this as sort of deviousness. Well, this is an extremely tricky way of pretending that you're not a part of the Cold War and thereby infiltrating all the better. But I don't think it was really that. I think there was a way in which it was that, because Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, had even said, you know, essentially that the Peace Corps is most effective as a part of our foreign policy to the extent that it's not a part of our foreign policy.
Yeah.
So I think that it had that part. But I also think that there was a way in which, again, tying back into the philosophical underpinnings, that the idea of treating people as ends in themselves, not as means, and that was applied both to the Peace Corps and to the people we intended to help, that if you just looked at this all as a tool of the Cold War, then you were, in a sense, denying the very spirit out of which it had been created.
The Peace Corps came into existence with this very imaginative mandate. I don't think anyone would dispute that characterization. But one thing that struck me about the organization then and now is that you were essentially entrusting a diplomatic function, in a sense, to a bunch of well-intentioned amateurs. And I use the word amateurs again advisedly. I don't mean unprofessional, but people who simply were not trained as diplomats. And the potential that you have for either great success or great disaster are enormous. Thousands of young Americans abroad in far distant places creates a vast potential for all kinds of things. So what was that the kind of official reaction to all of that like?
Well, I think certainly when it was first put out, there was a lot of derision aimed at the Peace Corps, that it was going to be a kiddie corps, that it could be, as Richard Nixon put it, a haven for draft dodgers, although this, you know, the Vietnam War was not really underway, but still there was conscription in the United States. There was still a draft. So, and then within the foreign policy establishment, although they were very diplomatic about it, as one would expect them to be, there was nevertheless a fair dose of skepticism. And this was not true just in the United States, by the way. The foreign policy establishments of these other countries also kind of wondered what was going on here.
And Britain and Australia.
Britain, Australia, mm-hmm. and France and Germany. And so you have a kind of mixed reaction and concern, level of concern in all of these countries about what will happen and what it can really accomplish. Because you said there's an aspect of this that's means you're exposing the country, that there's a vulnerability at work. At the same time, there was sort of a sense of, here you're going to send all these kids over to muck around in somebody else's affairs. You know, what really can they accomplish aside from whatever risk they might expose us to? But all in all, I have to say they were pretty good team players. You know, of course, don't forget, this was the president's baby.
That's right.
So it would be pretty hard for all the cabinet members whom he had personally appointed to be too, you know, obstreperous about cooperating with it.
Yeah. But what did the president want this baby to do in terms of precise goals?
Well, be darling, I'm sure. All parents want their children to be darling. In terms of the precise goals, there were three. The first was, I'm not quoting directly, but I'm paraphrasing here, that the first was to provide what they called middle-level manpower to developing countries. The idea of people who get in there and, you know, get down in the ditch and, you know, and dig. Whatever has to be done. And partly because of the idea that a lot of these countries just developing had not had an educated class, you know, historically that they could draw on as they were, you know, you had perhaps almost overeducated people who had gone to the former colonial centers and gotten their PhDs, and then you had all the people who were, you know, working in the fields and nobody in between. So the Peace Corps was going to provide those people. That was goal number one. Goal number two was to educate, in a sense, the world about America. Again, here's who we really are. The real Americans, as they like to say, not the plastic Americans, not the bureaucrats, not the racists, not the gangsters you see on the movies. You know, all of these images of America that the rest of the world is bombarded with that don't represent really us. These are our young people. They should represent who we really are. So that was the second goal. And the third goal was kind of an add-on, but I think in a lot of ways is the real meaning of the Peace Corps, which is that Americans will learn about the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And again, this ties back into the earlier history with the sense that Americans had often in the 50s. The criticism was made of America that we were so different from everybody else. Our lives were so blessed, in a sense. We were so exceptional in many different ways that we couldn't understand the rest of the world. And that was a dangerous handicap in fighting the Cold War, speaking of the Cold War.
There's a marvelous anecdote, Elizabeth, about the very day in which John Kennedy went forth to announce the creation of the Peace Corps. And as luck would have it, he was being visited then by Prime Minister Nehru, who was in the White House. So Kennedy walks back in and goes into the Oval Office, and he's sitting there chatting with Nehru in that sort of pre-session they all have. And he says, "Well, what do you think of that, Mr. Prime Minister? I just went out and announced a program that's going to send thousands of young Americans abroad to work in villages around the world, including many villages in India. What do you think of that?" And the Prime Minister turns to him and says, "I think it's great. American youth have a lot to learn from Indian villagers."
That's right. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
And to their credit, most of the volunteers really recognized that and endeavored to go in a spirit of humility. And in fact, that was part of what the Peace Corps encouraged.
Elizabeth, you brought us now to another point that it's very big part of your research, will be a big part of your book, and I think is, well, in many ways, the key ingredient in the entire story, and that is, what manner of men and women do we have going into this organization? under what motivations and to do what and in what kind of atmosphere. I think this is a this is really a big part of the story.
Well, Americans of every stripe responded to the Peace Corps. Not Americans of every stripe went into the Peace Corps, but Americans of every stripe responded. I was just at the Kennedy Library and reading some of the letters, these initial, that the came through across this initial wave of enthusiasm for the Peace Corps, and I was reading a letter from a railroad switchman who wrote and asked Kennedy to take him into the Peace Corps. So, but in terms of who actually came to the Peace Corps, they tended to be, almost uniformly at the beginning at least, college graduates. Most of them were what the Peace Corps called BA generalists, meaning these were liberal arts graduates. They did not tend to be highly technically oriented, although there were those people also. There were nurses and doctors and engineers who joined. But most of them were young people who wanted to experience the world, as young people do. And again, there's, in a sense, nothing wrong with that seeking of adventure. And in fact, this is very central in a lot of ways to the Peace Corps. This goes back to some of the things were identified by William James, our great American philosopher, who wrote in 1910 this little speech, which he called the moral equivalent of war. And the idea was that war is a lure for human beings, and that we're like moths attracted to the flame, and that that flame is partly the flame of adventure, and that there have to be moral equivalents to war that can bring out the human spirit. I was reading just in the Washington Post recently an article by Solzhenitsyn, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who talked about the problems of politics in the 20th century and where we're going in the 21st century, and the fact that politics always tries to fit things onto a two-dimensional plane of existence, and that actually life is three-dimensional. I think in some ways it's the Peace Corps is that being that third dimension of politics that doesn't quite fit, but is very fundamental and speaks to fundamental human needs for adventure and, most importantly, for meaning.
I want to probe now, this a bit more.
I want to turn this around, actually, because you were a Peace Corps volunteer, so I have to ask, and you went in the early 60s, why did you go?
For all of the above reasons, I think you're absolutely on target. Elizabeth, there's lots more to talk to you about. Let me just take a moment, though, to remind everyone that this program is Dialogue. My guest today is Elizabeth Cobbs, Associate Professor of History at the University of San Diego. Elizabeth Cobbs is currently at work on a history of the Peace Corps. And Elizabeth, having mentioned again what you are currently working on, I guess the immediate question there is why. What is it that you find particularly compelling in writing a history of the Peace Corps? I mean, why is that an important contribution to our understanding of the past three decades?
Well, I think it's very important because I think that we essentially do not understand the 1960s. It's a period that is still so much with us. It's too so recent. And that, you know, it still evokes such partisan response. I mean, I can, you know, the list is very long, going back as recently as the election in which Clinton had, we have the photo of Clinton with John F. Kennedy, and we have questions about his draft record. So the 60s is still very much with us, and it's a decade that has been used primarily by the Republican Party as example of all what was wrong with the Democratic Party. So, and since the Republicans have been dominant for most of this last three decades, then it distorts our knowledge of that decade. And I think it's also the case too that liberals feel very ashamed, or those, you know, they that what they accomplished was so much less than what they promised or what they hoped for, that it's our feelings about the decade are just tinged with so much sadness or anger that it makes it impossible to evaluate. So I think the Peace Corps is very interesting because it's a real window onto that decade, and it represents the point at which public pronouncements and political official policies and ideology converged with popular sentiment in a big way. So it tells us a lot about what people were really thinking, what they really wanted. It also, because there are equivalents around the world, the Peace Corps was not unique to the United States, but there were others in other Anglo countries and European countries, it tells us something about world aspirations and world problems at this period of time, and helps perhaps Americans to not realize that their troubles in this decade were not entirely unique.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, to conclude a conversation that I must say I have vastly enjoyed, I want to ask you kind of a once and future question. The once is in terms of what clearly once has happened, and that is that we have an organization that, if I take you correctly, was founded significantly in response to major forces at work in the world, like decolonization and the desire for universalism. And as we sit here in our world today, I think we might agree that new major forces at work in the world are things like ethnic dissension and conflict, population migrations, the big question of migrations of populations, and of course economic interdependence, a different set of challenges and questions. And having this additional dimension, it occurs to me that many of them kind of are inseparable in terms of where they're domestic and where they're foreign. They seem to be coming home in ways that we couldn't have anticipated. Immigration, that speaks for itself. Economic interdependence, the debate over NAFTA. I think we can see in many ways the fact that the world is losing its borders all around us. This is a kind of a big think question and maybe an unfair one to toss at you at the end of a conversation, but what do you make of all of that in terms of something like the Peace Corps and what it should be responding to now, based on both on its own achievements and character and the fact that once again, as it always does, the world is changing around us?
Well, I think that that much of what the Peace Corps is about has an enduring appeal and is timeless. So I think that there's much in what they do that can go on as is and make a major contribution. But I think that something which would be a very important litmus test for Peace Corps staff, directors, et cetera, to think about right now has to do with the fact that goes back to adventure. I do believe that, and in fact, this was a founder of the British voluntary service. He said that young people have to believe, and they'll know if they're not on the front lines, they have to believe that they are on the front lines, that you have not put them in a social service equivalent of collecting old books, library books for old age pensioners, that they have to know that they are right where the problem is really happening, not on some back burner. Well, the problem and the response to it in 1960 was to go to these decolonizing nations, to go to Africa, and to try and fill this middleman power need, which sounds like a very bureaucratic term, but for something that was created a real image. I mean, there were no people in between the highly educated Gandhis and Nehrus and the people who were riding the water buffalo. So this had a vividness that appealed to young people looking for adventure and looking to be their best selves. I was speaking to a former founder of the Peace Corps who was talking about the world AIDS crisis. You know, these are dramatic. These are the dramatic events of our times, the AIDS crisis, the, as you said, the flow of people across borders, the denationalizing of trade and things like this. I think that when Peace Corps administrators think to themselves, they need to think, where is the front line? And that's where our volunteers need to be.
And that's an excellent answer. And I have really enjoyed this conversation immensely. Thank you very
Same
much,
here.
Elizabeth
Thank
Cobbs.
You.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Elizabeth Cobbs Hoffman, author of All You Need Is Love, Peace Corps and the Spirit of the 60s. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our associate producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's RADIODIAL@AOL.com.